This is Where Did the Road Go? Our aim is to explore the fringe, to be true skeptics and question openly, to investigate the paranormal, bring light to the dark corners of history, and give a voice to the shunned of science. We deal in mystery and the important questions that these subjects bring to light. What is reality? Who are we? And why are we here? Join us on the web at wheredidtheroadgo.com for a full show archive, links to all our social media, upcoming schedule, and much, much more. Now, join your host Soraya on this week's edition of Where Did the Road Go?
And welcome to our Halloween show here on Where Did the Road Go? As we are initially broadcasting live on Halloween night, and I've picked a very good guest for that. We'll get to that in a minute. I want to mention again, we do have a Patreon account, and if you become a patron of the show, I'm going to have some special stuff just for patrons coming up, and as I've said, the interviews themselves, the main interviews, will always be free. You can go to wheredtheroadgo.com and download everything we've ever done interview-wise, but there's going to be some snippets and some special stuff just for patrons as well. If you think we should add something into the whole patron thing, you know, something special for patrons, let me know what it is. Let me know what you'd like. We're going to eventually have some merchandise, I hope. And you can find our Patreon link on wheredtheroadgo.com as well. All right. So our guest tonight is somebody we've had on a few times, and he has now written a book of his own experiences, and that is Steve Stockton.
Yes, sir. Glad to be here. Always happy to be on your show, Soraya.
And you're out on the West Coast, right?
Yes, that's right. Portland, Oregon.
But you grew up where?
Grew up in East Tennessee. Basically lived there for 40 years and then moved around a little bit after that. Orlando, Florida, Las Vegas, Nevada. And then about 6 years ago, arrived in Portland and like it here for now. I'll leave it at that.
All right. And you've written a book of your experiences, some of your experiences anyway, called My Strange World. And these things just kind of follow you around.
Yeah, it's like we were talking earlier. I'm not sure if I'm attracted to the strange or the strange is attracted to me or if it's a mutual attraction. But either way, it's made for an interesting life. It's rarely boring.
I know what that's like. If anyone is interested, they can go to wheredtheroadgo.com and click on the chat room, and they can leave comments or questions for you during the live broadcast here on WVBR. So let's get into this. You told us a little bit of this the first time you were on, but not in the detail that you go into in the book. Tell us a little bit about your first ghost experience.
First ghost experience, I was 6 years old. I was playing in the front yard of our house out in the country, waiting for my best friend to come home. Neighbor kid lived maybe a half a mile away. Like I said, we were out in the country, so that was about the closest neighbor. And I lived at the bottom of an inverted T intersection. So any cars coming down the road had to stop at the T and either turn left or turn right. And if they turned to their right, it dead ended into the lake. And that's the way my friends lived, was down that direction. Well, a car comes, stops at the intersection. I'm about halfway out in the yard, and just incidentally, our driveway was 212 feet long. I measured it later on when I was doing stuff with BMX bicycles. About halfway out in the yard, and I see the car stop, realize, that's not my friend, but I happen to see a kid run out from behind the car, didn't get out of the car, but just appeared from behind it, ran across in front of it, and I noticed that none of this was registering with the driver. I could still see the driver, elderly lady, bobbed hair, glasses. She obviously wasn't paying attention or didn't see what I saw, because, like I said, it didn't register that she was seeing a toddler run across the road. The kid runs across the road at an angle down into our yard, and if you've ever watched kids who just barely master the art of walking, sometimes they will run and get to the point where they can't control themselves and they'll just lose it and fall down. Mm-hmm. Well, that's what happened. This little kid, and I can still see him wearing his little blue shorts with suspenders, white shirt, blue cap, ran into the yard, fell, and just completely disappeared. I didn't take my eyes off the spot. I went directly to the spot. There's no kid there. There's no hole in the ground. There's no place a kid could have gone to. There's absolutely nothing there. At a later point, I even went back and took a little camping shovel and dug a hole there, thinking I might find a skeleton or something, but no evidence of anything there. And that's one of those things that just, it didn't frighten me, but it was just like, you know, that's not supposed to happen. I wonder what that was all about. And that's kind of been, that was kind of setting me up for the rest of my life. Like, what's that all about? You know, that's not supposed to happen.
Yeah, that's a weird one. And there's no, it seems like there's no rhyme or reason for it.
Yeah, I was told later on by my grandmother, who on my mother's side, who was a self-professed gypsy witch. She told fortunes with tea leaves and coffee grounds and things like that. She told me that I was born with a shine, and that that was her way of saying that I had, you know, like a third eye or a sixth sense or whatever. And she said that there would be certain things like that throughout my life that I would see that wouldn't make sense, but just served to let me know that I was a little different than other people and that I might often see things that either weren't there or didn't make a lot of sense.
And your family has some history of this, don't they?
Yeah, it goes back quite a ways. Like I said, she was the fortune teller. They did other things. They were very involved in the early spiritualism movement, and they did the rappings and the table tappings, the levitations, Ouija boards, a little bit of everything.
Hmm. Do you think that contributed? Do you think it's in the blood?
I think to a certain extent it would have to be. I think if you grow up around that, you're going to absorb so much of it, or if nothing else, maybe develop a neurosis and push it as far away as possible. But I think that's what it was, just that and being around it. And these were also, especially my grandmother and some of her sisters, they're very old country type people, very superstitious. And I think just being around that and hearing all that, it made me more open to it.
Hang on. Sorry about that. Your brother also saw a doppelganger of himself.
Yeah, I had an older brother. He's quite a bit older than I am, 17 years older. And one day when he was a child, not too far from where my incident with my first apparition happened, he was playing with his wagon. And there was a dirt road beside the house where they lived. And he saw an image of himself pulling a red wagon up the dirt road with a Bible in it. And he said it was just as real. He said, you know, I knew it was me. I could see me from behind. I recognized the clothes I was wearing. I recognized my wagon. And his thought was, well, I'll get my wagon and I'll go in the house and find a Bible and I'll put it in the wagon and pull it up the hill and see what happens. And he did that. And then lo and behold, you know, 35 years later, he becomes a minister of a church. So he thinks that it was just something early on where he was being shown what his path in life could be if he chose to go along with it and follow it. So interesting concept there.
Has he had anything else happen like that?
He's had some strange experiences. He's experienced hairy creatures, you know, Bigfoot, hominid type things. He mentioned one morning early when he was out hunting, he saw what he thought was some sort of apparition by an old well house. So he's had some experiences too. It runs in the family. Every one of us. I've got a daughter. She's seen things that she can't explain. And then people that I've been involved with, like relationships that I've been in and things, it's affected those people as well. Like anybody I was with, they would know, okay, well, strange things are happening. What's going on? So,
huh.
So never a dull moment.
Yeah, it makes you wonder how this stuff manifests, like, and why, rather than just, you know, there's people like yourself or myself where you see so much of it and other people don't, but if people spend time around you or whatever, then sometimes they start seeing it as well. It seems like it just can't be random at that point.
Yeah, I think so. And there's people that are just hard and fast that never see anything.
Yeah.
And then I think it was Einstein that once said that some people see miracles every day and other people never see them. So again, I think it's what you're open to, what your perception is and how you look at things, you know?
Now, one of the things you talk about in the book is that you have Asperger's.
Yeah, I've had Asperger's as a kid. Not so much now, I don't think. Hopefully not. I'm still have some OCD tendencies and things. But, yeah, as a child, I had everything was very ritualized. It had to be done a certain way and in a certain order, like in the mornings getting up and getting ready to go to school. There was certain things I had to do and certain things I had to look at and touch before I went to school. I know it sounds totally wackadoo now, but it was just that was my life as a kid, you know, and I didn't
– Sure.
Never had anybody say, you know, hey, don't do that, or why are you doing that? Because a lot of it was very private. Even my parents weren't aware of it to an extent.
And I wonder how much that plays into you being able to notice stuff as well.
Yeah, I think it does heighten the perception. And, I mean, I can walk in a room and tell you if the pictures are hanging just a little crooked or if the rug's just a little off, and I'll usually go fix those things. So.
Right, so I'm wondering if maybe you notice things that other people would just overlook because of that.
I think that's true, even just normal, you know, nondescript things. I often find money on the ground, and people I'm with, you know, walk right by it, and I've already seen it and making my way over to it. Or slight perceptions and things like change in temperature or lighting or things like that easily picked up on. So maybe that does, you know, one affects the other.
Yeah, yeah. Tell us the story of the ghostly kittens, because this is pretty weird.
Yeah, that very interesting story. Again, like basically all these in there, there is no rational explanation that held fast. I found out that I could lay in my bedroom as a child. We had a house custom built for us. Started in 1962, the year before I was born. And I can actually remember my dad taking me and standing me up inside the flooring of the house, the subflooring, when I was about 6 months old. So my memory goes way far back. But I found out probably sometime I was around 10, 11 years old that if I laid on the floor in my room, and these were hardwood floors with just area rugs on them, then I could hear kittens underneath the house. And not just one, but sounded like, you know, a litter of kittens. And this could be heard basically if I had the patience any time of day or night, any time of year. And obviously, you and I both know kittens don't stay kittens very long.
Right.
But I would hear these kittens. I mean, I think the first time I heard it was in the wintertime, and I actually had to wait until warmer weather, like in the spring, to go investigate. And the house just had a crawl space underneath it. It was louvered, but with a little half-inch grate on it, so nothing's coming in or out. There was only one entry or access point, a little wooden door that my dad kept padlocked. And I actually went under there, unlocked it, went in with a flashlight, and crawled the entire length of the crawl space. And when you got up toward the garage end of the house, there was only, you know, a few inches clearance there between my head and the floor joist. But there were no cats anywhere in there, no cats, no kittens. And I literally heard those for years. The last time I heard them was the last night I spent in the house. We had moved up the road when I was in high school, a few miles to a subdivision, and my bed had already gotten moved, and we still had some things in the house, and I decided to stay there just in case. I didn't want anybody to mess with anything that was still there. I slept on the floor, and I heard the kittens mewling all night long. That was about four or five years after I first experienced it.
Well, that's just so bizarre.
And one of those things on why, you know, what would be the point? Why would you hear kittens? You know, that's...
Yeah.
Huh. And I have good hearing, you know. I've never hallucinated that I'm aware of or anything like that. And I think if I was having that kind of problems, it would be more than just kittens mewling.
Well, you said other people heard them too.
Yeah. I had a friend that would come over, and he could hear them. It would take him longer and seemed like he would have to concentrate more. And at first it was like, well, I was like, you're crazy. There's no kittens under there. And after maybe two or three days of trying, then all of a sudden he jumped up and his eyes were big. He's like, you're right, I heard kittens under there. So it's...
Huh. I
wasn't the only one, but for some reason they were easier for me to hear. And the strange part about that, neither one of my parents could hear them. They would try. My dad looked all over. He didn't care much for cats and thought, you know, there were cats living under the house and he wanted them out of there, but he could never hear them, never find any trace of them. My mom wasn't really big on, especially kittens. She had some kind of strange phobia of small kittens. So she didn't want anything to do with them, and they couldn't hear them. And I find that strange, but I've read later on scientific data that there are certain tones and things that younger people can hear that older people cannot. So maybe there's some sort of, I don't know, some sort of shift or something there in the time and space that allows me to hear kittens that aren't there when I was a kid and nobody else could hear or only other kids could hear.
Yeah, that one's, I mean, it's not a scary story, but it's definitely a weird one.
Yeah, it just gave you pause for thought, you know, like, why? And again, it's one of those things that there is no real explanation other than it's a part of me being different.
Well, let's go on to one of the ones that actually scared you. Let's talk about the thing in the ditch.
That one, that frightens me to this day to think about. And a lot of that because I'm not frightened. I mean, I described the apparition that I saw when I was 6 years old. That didn't scare me. I'm one of these people, you can take me, put me out in a cemetery. I'll walk through from one end to the other midnight and get your name off a tombstone in the back of it, bring it out to you. I just, stuff like that doesn't scare me. But on this particular day, it was daylight. It was in the fall. It was afternoon. I think I had been to school that day. So it would have been, you know, 3-4 in the afternoon. There's an old ditch up beside our property, the north end of the property, in the woods between our land and the farm next door. And I was just playing along the top of the ditch. I think I had a BB gun with me, probably playing Army or something. And I turned around and walked away from the ditch. And as I walked away, something that I could not see came up over the top of the ditch. And it was moving in such a way that it was kicking up leaves, like something running very fast, but there was absolutely nothing there, just the movement of the leaves. And I could hear the footfalls. You know, it sounded heavy, the size of an adult human or larger, coming straight toward me. So I took off down the hill, and I could hear it right behind me. And I was making enough noise that when I got finally to the backyard, my mom had came out on the back porch to see what all the commotion was. And I ran past her and went on in the house. I guess I was going to let it get her. But she didn't see anything, didn't experience anything, didn't see anything behind me. And, but you know, this was probably from a quarter mile away where it first started. So she couldn't have seen the leaves being kicked up or anything. And really spooked me. Like I said, it took a lot to shake me up and scare me, but that one definitely did. When my father came home from work, my brother had just happened to ride with him that day. My brother, being so much older than I was, he already had his own life and was married and had stuff going on. But he had ridden to work with my brother that day. They worked out the plants in Oak Ridge. And I was telling them about it, just, you know, breathless, scared. And they actually took a couple of pistols and went up there, looked it over. Couldn't find any evidence of anything. I, you know, showed them right where the spot was. Nothing. And then the neighbor kid and I would try to use him as bait. I would hide down the hill behind some trees. You go up and stand on the ditch and, you know, whatever it is, run by and I'll see what it is when it chases you out of here. Didn't bother him. It was, you know, absolutely nothing happened. And then I tried it again by myself and something came out of the ditch and chased me. And not just a couple of occasions, but on two or three occasions. And again, one of the last times was not too long before we moved from there. I was, you know, kind of kicking around. I was like 15 at the time, and I'm thinking, yeah, I wonder what that was that scared me when I was a kid. You know, I'm going to go up here and look around. Oh, there's nothing up here. I don't see anything. All of a sudden, out of the top of the ditch, leaves are blowing up, and I'm gone.
Huh. And you talk about the possibility of maybe it being sort of an elemental spirit.
Yeah, that's what I was told. I was at a party in probably about 1982 or 1983, a good 5 years or so since that incident happened, 5 or 6 years. And some girls were playing with a Ouija board. And I didn't really know anybody at the party. I had, you know, friend of a friend, one of those types of things. Didn't really know any of the people there. And they were going around the room and having people ask questions. And they knew absolutely nothing about me. And my question was, what scared me when I was a child? Can you tell me that? They asked the Ouija board and spelled out water sprite. And that was just, you know, that's I looked it up. I didn't even know what really that was. I had an idea. I thought it was more of a nymph or a fairy type thing, but it is an elemental that hangs out in the woods near springs. Well, it just so happens the property where this ditch was, just down from there, down the hill a little ways, there were 7 natural springs on that property that ran together and flowed into the lake. So who knows? But that's as good an explanation as I have.
Well, yeah. When something invisible goes chasing you across the, you know. And the other sort of weird one like that was the Beast of Swenson Road.
Yeah, that was another one that we actually saw that one, and thankfully it didn't give chase because it looked like it could have eaten us. But I was playing with my friend James. I'd gone home with him after school. We were maybe 10, 11 years old, and his family enjoyed their privacy, and they had this really long gravel driveway. It was probably, I'm guessing, somewhere in the neighborhood of a mile long. They lived a ways off the road out in the country. And we were about halfway down this gravel driveway, so you couldn't see anything in any direction. You know, you couldn't see the house, nor could you see the paved road. And there was some old shacks there. I don't know what had been on the property at one time. It looked like it might have been a chicken coop or something like that. And there was also a kind of a gravel pit there where they had dug into the side of the bank, a lot of shale and big rocks and things busted up there. We were messing around in the gravel pit trying to find some fossils. And we happened to look up on the hill above us, which was a little sheer cliff face, maybe 15, 20 feet tall, where we're at down in this little gravel pit. And then the shack is up on top of there. And there's this thing looking at us. To this day, I have trouble describing it. It looked somewhat like a man, but with a horse's head. It had very equine features, but it had like the mouth of a human extended out like a horse. And it smiled at us, and it had like these big sharp teeth and these big round eyes. And just, we both let out a yell, ran back up the half mile to his house, tried to convince his parents that we had seen something. They were just like, you boys, you just, it's your imagination, or you're making things up, or you're trying to play a prank or whatever. But we were very serious. And again, independently, we drew pictures of what we saw, and it came up with very similar looking drawings. And we didn't hang around that part of his property anymore when we were there. These were people that had several hundred acres. And anytime I went back, as far as I could remember, we stayed pretty close to the house. We did not go down to the gravel pit.
Now, is this where he also burned that building sometime later?
Yeah, the dad, they'd had some other strange experiences later on after that. And the dad kind of thought that maybe there was somebody hanging around there, like a child predator or something like that. Mm. And later on, he pushed it down with a tractor and burned it. Huh. And either that or just the fact not going to that area anymore. We never had any more problems, and my friend James never reported anything else either. But spooked him as well. He had never had any encounter like that. But it's, if you can imagine a stocky, kind of pot-bellied man with a horse's head and sort of morphing into human features, it's almost like in, I think it was Peter Pan, where the boys are turning into donkeys. Kind of like that. That would be the best description I can think of.
Wow. The, you don't even know what to make of a story like that.
And said I was a kid. I wasn't on any medications. We weren't smoking or drinking. I was, you know, a teetotaler until I was into my late teens, early 20s. I never drank until I was old enough to buy it for myself. So, you know, no explanation like that for him.
And the fact that you both saw it as well says something.
Yeah.
So you talk in the book about a number of different cemeteries you spend time in, which is something I've always enjoyed, going to cemeteries at night, especially certain ones, because certain ones definitely have a weird feel to them, whereas others really don't. So you want to get into some of that, some of the experiences you've had there?
Sure. There's some, like you said, that are just, they have a certain vibe to them. Some are very peaceful. I consider, you know, a necropolis, a city of the dead, if you will. And there's one in Knoxville, Tennessee called Old Gray Cemetery that there's been some strange activity there, but it's basically, that's the place you would want to go if you wanted to see the lost art of stone carving. There are some very, very articulate stones in there. I mean, look like fallen trees. They're things that I didn't recognize were carved stone until closer inspection. But then there are other cemeteries that have, you know, just like you said, something weird going on. There's a Methodist cemetery in the Solway community of West Knoxville, where I grew up, that I've spent a lot of time in. And it's one of those places that, and I've found a couple of different cemeteries not too far away that are like this, but anytime you go in there, if it's a bright, sunny day, it will inexplicably become cloudy. The wind will kick up. It may even rain a little bit. It's just like something doesn't really appreciate you being there. And in the Methodist cemetery, it's kind of sits above the road. So if you're driving around through there at night, there's been people that have seen things in the cemetery, heard things. I myself have experienced what looked like a child popping out from behind a stone about midnight one night. There's also, there used to be a stone in there that had a little girl's doll sealed in glass in the back of it, but vandals broke the glass and took the doll. But it was told that if you went there at night, that the doll, you could see it blink or move its mouth or something like that. I never got to experience that. Like I said, somebody went in and destroyed it. And you run into a lot of that. I mean, when I go to a cemetery, I'm very respectful. I don't walk on the graves. But I've seen people, you know, biking through, and I've been to cemeteries where the tombstones have been knocked over or vandalized, spray paint, graffiti, you know, like with the guys with their heavy metal parties and stuff. And I just, that bothers me. But there's another one in Karnes area called Beaver Ridge Cemetery. And this one is very famous, or infamous, if you will. There's been reports of glowing stones, somebody in a cape stabbing a knife into the ground. And there's was an old Masonic lodge there that had also been a school and at one time a church. So you've got this creepy building and then this totally Hollywood movie set looking graveyard there with, you know, a lot of family plots. And I knew a lot of people that were buried there, knew their grandchildren and things. And that one's kind of funny. I talk about my friend Will and I had actually gone in there to check it out one night and discovered some girls that we went to school with, some cheerleaders, were there on a dare apparently, and we scared them. But then there was also somebody in there besides us helping us scare them that we never were able to identify who they were or where they came from. So
you want to tell that one in a little more detail, because that's fascinating.
Yeah, that one, it was one of those things where we'd heard these stories growing up, and the cemetery's still there now. The Masonic Lodge, it's since been pushed down. It was dangerous. It was one of those places where, you know, people dared each other to go in. It was a three-story building, and it had all kinds of water damage, and there had been things in there. But on this one, yeah, we kind of planned it out. We parked at the school and walked 2 or 3 miles on the road and went into this cemetery, hid ourselves in there at night. I was in a tree, and my friend was behind a tombstone. And we were just kind of looking around, you know, trying to see what was going on. Well, sure enough, here comes some girls that we know. And they were there on, I guess it's like a dare or some kind of cheerleader activity or something. I don't try to scare each other. So we're thinking, you know, this is great. And we just happened to be here on the night that this was happening. And about the time they got close to where we were, my friend pops out from behind a stone. I dropped out of a tree. So they're running, screaming. We're chasing them. And then off to the side, we see a shadow figure that had came out of the area where this particular part of the cemetery, that backside of it, there's no houses. There's just some high weeds back there. We saw somebody else helping chase. So we ran back into the cemetery, hid in these high weeds, and kind of looked around. Never did see the other person, what happened to them, where they came from, any of that. And just, that's another one of those cemeteries that anytime I've been in there, day or night, it will cloud up, the wind will blow really hard. You can expect rain and things. Somebody had a YouTube video of it that I watched not too long ago, and they'd experienced kind of the same thing. They're like, it was weird. There was no wind until I got my camera out and started trying to film, and then this weird wind came up out of nowhere. But there are tombstones there that glow, but I think that's not so much supernatural as just the quartz composition or whatever's ground up or composite in that stone. So there are some strange things there, some things that don't necessarily make a lot of sense. But then it's also like what we were doing. It's a hotbed for a place for kids to go and dare one another to do things. So sometimes I'm not sure how much of that is imagination and how much of it's actual.
Sure.
You know, something paranormal, and one can feed on the other, but I think it depends on your attitude and your reverence and your willingness to open yourself up to experiencing the strange things.
And it also seems to me like the older the cemetery, the more likely there's going to be something weird there. And I wonder if in the older days, it seems like they would have put cemeteries in sacred spots. Whereas modern-day cemeteries are put where we have land. Mm-hmm. So I wonder if those sacred spots are what caused the paranormal activity as opposed to it being a cemetery. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, that maybe that's why it was chosen to put a cemetery there, because there was already something existing.
Yeah.
So David Politis talks about that in his work, how a lot of the places that have devil names, they had named that, you know, because of things that had happened there, not the other way around.
Right.
But it's interesting when you look at some of that stuff, you know, Devil's Cliff and Satan's Precipice and all this, that a lot of times places that have those weird devil names, there are things that have happened there, something strange, something that couldn't be explained. And that's kind of what his work was talking about, was, is it because it has the name, or was it already named that because of something that happened and the more strange things? So
yeah, I know he had a hard time tracking the names. Andrew Collins had made the same observation in Light Quest, and again couldn't really track down where the names had originated from.
Mm-hmm. But I think there's something to that. I think there's something in a name. I think that you could, you know, if you started calling something by that name, that maybe it attracts that kind of energy, or
maybe
puts that thing there. Who knows? It makes for a good story.
Wasn't there also a story in there in one of the cemeteries where you were with a girl and she saw what she thought was a little kid?
Yeah, that was the Methodist cemetery that I mentioned earlier. I've seen the same kid in there, and she was kind of scared, wanted a hug, and she's just like, I just saw a kid pop between the tombstone. And I just smiled, you know, because I've been in there by myself before and saw that. It's a same kid, looks like he's probably wearing clothes from maybe the 40s or 50s, and you'll just catch a glimpse of him. Have no idea who he is or what the story is, but I've seen him on more than one occasion, and I know probably half a dozen people that could attest to the same.
And you said you waited till you got in the car with her to tell her that it was
to tell her the story. Yeah, there's a certain, you know, you want to. At the time, you know, I was dating this girl, and it was okay to get her a little scared and clingy, but you didn't want her to run off screaming. You know, kind of a fine line there you had to tread for a while. But yeah, once you get in the car, then you can make it a little scary and a little scarier, and then it's then they're basically sitting in your lap.
Oh, so you lived in a house in Las Vegas, and this thing had some really weird stuff going on in it. And I think the first time you were on, you told us a little bit about this, but not in the detail you went into in the book.
Yeah, I think I did mention it briefly. That was the most active haunted house I've ever lived in, if you want to call it haunted or just active. It's supernaturally active. Lived in several, but that one was, there was just something weird there. It was an older house for Las Vegas. It was built in the 1930s. And basically there was no Vegas as in the Strip or anything like that before the mid-40s. You had the downtown area that had been there, you know, since the turn of the century. But where this house was, it was several miles from downtown and built in such a time that the Strip was non-existent. So literally when it was built in the middle of nowhere. In the basement of the house, one of the features was a hidden room behind a bookcase at the bottom of the stairs, which I love. You know, I'm a big fan of the Hammer horror films and stuff, and I saw the basement, like, you know, I got to rent this. This is awesome. And there was also some kind of weird rooms or almost antechambers down there where had one room with a sort of arched thing in the back and then a window that went into another room inside the house, you know, like windows between the rooms inside. And there were some people that lived up the street that had been in the neighborhood since the 50s. And the house was there when they moved in and built their house. And they claimed that it had been all kinds of things from like a church where some kind of strange cult met, as well as a mafia safe house. So really interesting place. At the time, I had a photography business and had my photography studio in the basement. And on weekends, I would have get-togethers and have model shoots. I was doing editorial and fashion photography. And one of the things that would happen often upstairs in like the kind of a staging area, when the models would show up, I would have, you know, hors d'oeuvres and drinks and things waiting on them. And have them sit upstairs while I got my studio ready, set my lights up, my backdrops and things, whatever I was doing. And they would often hear a voice, like just whisper in their ear, kind of behind them, saying rude things, telling them, oh, you're not very pretty for a model, or, you know, just all this really weird stuff. And I had a couple of girls almost get into a fight one night with another girl because they thought she was saying nasty things about them. And I kind of told them, well, you know, was it upstairs in the living room? And they're like, yeah. And I'm like, okay, well, I hear voices up there sometimes. And, and had another girl that I was in the kitchen getting something ready that night, a fruit platter, and she came running in and like skidded on her heels. And she's like, I'm out of here. There's something in there. Like, and it was actually saying nice things to her, but that was what was wigging her out, I think. And then also, I had a model over once. She was kind of a tough girl from Detroit and didn't really believe in things like this. And I had her against a brick wall shooting this outfit that she had. It was like a rockabilly type getup. And I've got these pictures somewhere. You had asked me about some of my photography. I needed to find these frames. But literally in one frame, you can see her in this rockabilly dress, back of her leg, nothing. The next frame, there's three bloody scratches down the back of her leg. I mean, it's just, and look at the time and date stamp, and it's like 0.2 seconds between the frames because I had it on a burst shoot. And I didn't really know it at the time, but that scared her for being somebody that was tough. And she's like, you know, no, you don't understand. She's like, that's demonic. I'm like, what are you talking about? Because I didn't really know that part of it. But apparently, anytime you have something that's done in a three like that, especially a scratch, it is a mockery of the Trinity by some sort of demonic entity. And she left and never returned. I shot with her some other shoots at different occasions, but she would never come back to my studio. And also in that house, I had a room in the basement where I used as my bedroom. And I had a clothes rack, just a rod, a wooden rod, a dowel between two partitions and some built-in shelving, and kept falling out of the little holders. And one night it fell out. I put it back up there, and I actually put screws in the end, through the shelving, into the end of the dowel, hung all my clothes up there, and I was like, okay, now let's see what you can do. I turned the lights out. And had much more than laid down, then boom, I heard all the clothes hit the floor again. And this was like, you know, dress slacks, shirts, jackets, and things on hangers. So I get up and I turn on the light. The dowel is still in place, still screwed into the wood. That's where I put it, solid as a rock. But all my clothing, still on the hangers, was off the dowel and just laid in a row like dominoes, you know, just straight line, still on the hangers. And I'm just like, okay, that's fine. You want them in the floor? I'm going to leave them in the floor. I got to get some sleep. And it would just be little weird things like that, you know, like a sort of a war of the wills. There was times when I would know 100% certain that I was the only one in the house. I would try to take a tub bath. It had a really nice soaking tub, a big garden tub, if you will, in one of the rooms, kind of a sunken tub. And I would no more than get in there and start my soak than it would sound like somebody dragging a couple of trash cans up and down the hardwood floor hallway. And I'd get out, dry off. First time, you know, I thought somebody had broken in and was stealing all my stuff from the sound of it. Go out there, there's nothing out there. Didn't see any sign of anything.
Well, hang on for 1 second. We're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back with Steve Stockton.
Where Did the Road Go can be heard first and usually live on WVBR, Saturday nights at 11 p.m. Eastern. go to wheredidtheroadgo.com to ask questions of our live guests through the chat room. Where Did the Road Go is then re-aired on Dark Matter Radio and Deprogrammed Radio. You can download all shows for free on the website, and you can subscribe to us on Stitcher, iTunes, YouTube, or Vimeo. Additional content can be found on our video channels. You will also find our upcoming schedule, book reviews, blogs, free book downloads, links, and more. We are also on Facebook and Twitter, and if you want to help support the show, there are links to donate to us. Everything you need can be found at wheredidtheroadgo.com.
And that also leaves out that we're also on Intrepid Radio now, and there's a Patreon link, the way you can become a member or a patron of the show, and essentially it's going to be like a membership for Where Did the Road Go, where you get some exclusive stuff. All right, and we are talking with Steve Stockton about My Strange World, his new book. And this is book number 3, right?
Yeah, and not really a part of the Strange Things in the Woods series. This is just a different book, but yeah, it's the third one that I've published.
Now, this house in Vegas, you also talk about a little dog you had there.
Yeah, I had a little rescue dog. He was half Corgi and half German Shepherd, and yeah, he was as odd as that sounds. It's like a full-size German Shepherd body with these tiny little legs. And there were parts in the house that he would not go near for. I mean, he loved to eat, but you could not even coax him in with food. Like the hallway that I talked about where the garbage cans, I would hear that. He wouldn't want to come through there at all. He would go out the doggy door, go around the back side of the house, come in another door, another doggy door, and get to his food that way when it would have been, you know, maybe 12, 15 feet in one direction. He would rather go out and go all the way around the house. So he avoided that hallway. There were other spots that he would just kind of sit and stare at, or other times he didn't really care for the living room. He would go in there, but a lot of times something would scare him and he would run out. And that was also where we heard the voices, you know, the not so quiet, tiny little voice right behind your ear.
Okay, and wasn't there an incident where the dog was actually held down?
Yeah, that was one of the first times that he tried to come through the hallway. And it looked like he was on his belly, had his legs splayed out, and like he was trying to pull himself. And he was letting this the most unearthly whine, growl, almost a scream type thing that I'd ever heard. And I thought there was something wrong with the dog. I thought literally he was having a seizure or something. And then when he saw me and I kind of talked to him and I went toward him. And about the time I got there, whatever it was broke, and he jumped up and ran down the hallway. And that's when he started going out and around the house and avoiding the hallway at all costs. So whatever it was, just imagine, you know, a small dog and something pressing him down into the floor, just kind of splaying him out.
And you did a seance in this place.
Yeah, when the room under the stairs there behind the bookcase, it wasn't a really big room, like maybe 20 by 20, 25 by 25, something like that. A couple of models that I worked with, twin sisters that claimed to have a sixth sense or whatever, they wanted to have a seance. So I let them have a seance there one night, and they had candles and Ouija boards and stuff. And it's a lot of strange things took place. I mean, the candles would go out, the Ouija board was threatening them. And that was another night we had one girl that left and swore never to come back.
And you did ask it what was there, right?
Yeah, and it told us that there was, you know, there were spirits there. There were things that had been there. There were things that had been drawn there, and there were things that had been sent there. So that's kind of chilling when you think about it.
Yeah, but fascinating at the same time.
Absolutely.
And that kind of freaked you out a little, didn't it?
Yeah, they got to play seance and go home, and I had to put everything up and go to bed. And like I said, I was kind of used to it. It was... You know, I didn't bother it so much. It didn't bother me, but it would do things from time to time to let me know it was there. But it could take on a very heaviness. I believe it was something demonic. I mean, I've felt what I consider benevolent or light spirits, you know, that don't mean any harm. But this had a darker edge to a really more of a, you know, don't mess with me, or you don't know what you're messing with, or you don't want to mess with me type thing. So So it had a few little push comes to shove, and I would just back off. But later on, we actually had the house smudged with sage and sea salt spread in all the corners and things. And last I heard, there hadn't been any more problems with it there.
Now, your roommate there, she really didn't have any notable experiences up to a point, right?
Yeah, well, she was also one of these people that never really experienced anything and wasn't really sure what she believed in. And she would have some of the same experiences that I've had. Like, she would hear the voices and she'd think, oh, you know, it's just the neighbors talking. But, you know, the neighbors aren't telling you, you know, you're not very pretty for a model or things like that.
So right.
She would just kind of, I don't know, just kind of shove it off, you know, and not think much about it. But eventually, you know, she had experiences too where she believed. And then eventually she was upside down in the mortgage in the house. So we eventually had to move out of there. But
well, you were talking about one particular experience in the book that she had where she heard what she thought was you coming into the house.
Yeah. Yeah. That was the one that got her. I'd been out at Red Rocks doing an on-location shoot. She thought I was back from Red Rocks, came in to see, because yeah, she said she heard me, you know, putting my gear away, heard me shutting the closet, heard me shutting the door, heard me walking in the kitchen and opening the refrigerator. She comes out of her bedroom. There's nobody in the house. She looks all over. All the doors are locked. We had alarms on the doors and windows. Nobody, no physical entity had been in the house. And she got really spooked and ended up, I think she texted me or called me and said, can I come out to where you are? So she came and hung out at the shoot with me until time to go back home. So,
wow. And then you worked at Bally's for a while.
Yeah, I was worked at Bally's Casino there on the Vegas Strip. I was an in-house photography lab manager. And what a lot of people don't know is that where Bally's is now, that was the site of the old MGM that caught fire. I want to say it was 1983, and there were, I think, 70 or 80 people that died in that fire. There was a fireball that just swept the casino floor and took a lot of people out that way. And then in the upper floors, just because of the smoke and things, there are people that died of smoke inhalation, and even a few people that jumped out of the windows on the Koval side there and splattered on the pavement. So instead of just, I don't know, tearing it down, which they seem to love to do in Vegas, I mean, just in the few years that I was out there, they imploded at least three casinos that I remember. But this one, instead of deciding to tear it down and start fresh, they just did a retrofit. And where the old part of MGM is, they just, you know, kind of shoehorned the new Bally stuff in there. But you have places in the back, up the fourth of the casino there, that are still part of the old MGM. In fact, if you watched any of the old celebrity roasts, the Dean Martin roast from back in the 70s, that's the showroom that I handled the photography for. I was upstairs in the back, and there was a lot of strangeness up there where the green rooms and the dressing rooms were. There were people that claimed to have seen Dean Martin. He had a fear of elevators, so they had a special little apartment built for him there, where he wouldn't have to ride the elevator. And then people claimed they've seen him near there or outside there. He had a little putting green. Had the same setup at the Riviera, but that one's gone now. I think they tore it down. But there in the part where the photography lab was, there was a lot of things that would go on. The first day I went there, I worked for a company that had the concession for basically all the major casinos. So I'd worked at a lot of different casinos. As I started as a relief manager until I got my own spot. And when I was assigned Bally's, the first day I get there, I unlock the door and I walk into the lab, turn the lights on, and just, you know, something doesn't feel right here. And I knew a little bit about the history, but not that much. And in this particular lab, there was an area back in the back, had been the dark room back in the days. We shot digital while I was there, but prior to that, they had actually shot on film. And this is the souvenir photographer. You go to a show, you go to dinner, a girl with a camera will come up and take your picture and then try to hustle and sell it to you after the show. So this area that used to be the dark room, it's a little sliding like a pocket door. Notice the light's on back there and the door's open. Okay, turn the light off, close the door, looking around, familiarizing myself. There's also a electrical access panel that's standing open. I close it back. It's one of the ones where you actually have to push it in and turn it, a little handle to get it to close. But I go ahead, I turn my printer on. We got these literally $500,000 beast of a printers that had to power up and then warm up and go through their cycles and stuff. I'm waiting for that to come up. Walk back in the back again. I notice pocket doors open, lights on again, access panels open. Went through this about two or three times, and finally I'm just like, okay, if you want it open, I'm going to leave it open. And that would happen lots of times. And I've since then talked to other photographers that when they were shooting there, they would have similar experiences. Another time I had a couple of brothers who were my runners, and what they did, they would go and pick the digital cards up out of the showroom from the photographers, bring them up for me, and I print the pictures. And then after the show broke, they would help the photographers carry their albums down and try to sell them the pictures. Well, we're just sitting there taking it easy. It's not time to do a pickup yet. And all of a sudden, I see this black, formless mass. It was about the size of a human, maybe twice as wide as a person, about 6-7 feet tall. Comes out of one wall and just kind of moves, undulates across the room, goes through back in the area where the access panel was, and goes into another wall. Well, I see things sometimes. I wasn't going to say anything about it, but these two brothers look at one another, and they're like, did you see that? And these were Hispanic Catholic kids, so they start crossing themselves, and, you know, Dios mío, and they left and wouldn't come back. I had to call across the street to another casino. I think I had some people come over from maybe it's Harrah's or somewhere like that to come and be my runners that night. And then another night I had one of the upper management come by, and he had started out as a lab manager just like I was. And he kind of comes, looks around, sticks his head in here, and he's like, I never did like this place when I had to work here. And I'm just, you know, I'm playing dumb, like, oh, really? And he's like, yeah, there's something in that back room. I can never get that door to stay shut and that light to turn on.
Nice. So
little things like that, you know. And again, it's what you're open to. There's probably other people you could talk to that worked in that lab for years and never felt anything. I mean, we had a couple of older ladies that had started out with the company when they were very young. One lady actually has a badge that says, Welcome to the Elvis Show, from where she used to shoot at the Hilton, wow, Old International Hotel. And she, nothing bothers her, but one of my coworkers said, "Dad, the devil himself would be afraid of her." So no wonder she's never seen a ghost.
Okay, let's get to a couple of these other ones. There's a lot of stuff in this book. We're only like kind of scratching the surface of the things in this book. So, but one of the ones I thought was really interesting was the haunted photograph.
Yeah, that happened when I was a kid. There was an elderly lady that my mom used to go visit. It was somebody that had been friends with her grandmother when she was a little girl. And this lady, she would donate to like the International Children's Fund or something like that. And they would send her these pictures of orphans in other countries, you know, begging to feed them or clothe them or send them to school or whatever. And she would save all kinds of stuff like that, put in a little cigar box. And when we went to visit, I was like maybe 5 years old or something. I'd go visit my mom maybe, I'm saying we go once a month or something like that. She would have all this little ephemera that she would give to me. And it would be, you know, like prayer cards and cereal coupons and bottle caps and just, you know, stuff that a kid would have fun with. And there would be these little pictures of the orphans from like Guatemala or somewhere like that. It was a foreign country. And I took those home and played with them. And I would, you know, put stuff in a book, or I would take the pictures and make up stories about the kids. You know, I was a budding writer even as a child. And there was one particular photograph, and the kid just, I mean, now you hear about the black-eyed kids. I think this was actually a photograph of a black-eyed kid. The kid's eyes were so dark, and just the countenance was so evil, it scared me just to look at the photograph. And I tossed it away, and this was out in the country. I mean, years and years ago. Back then it was legal to burn your garbage, and that was what we did. Something like Friday nights, maybe on the weekends, my dad would burn the garbage, and sometimes that was my job to help him with that. Well, I put the photo in the garbage. The garbage was burned. A couple weeks later, I'm playing in the living room, and I used to store things under the couch. That was my desk, if you would. As I knew my mom would mess with stuff under there. Well, I'm poking around under the couch looking for something else. I lift up the flap, and there sitting against the couch leg is the picture of this little boy that I had thrown in the garbage. And again, just that evil look, it gave me chills. And to this day, I don't know. I feel like there was something attached to that photograph. If you've heard any of the legends, like the painting, The Crying Boy, where there's a child in tears, and it's claimed that the artist tortured the kid to get him to cry so he could paint him like that. And then the homes where these paintings have hung have been found burned, and then the only thing left unscathed would be the photograph of the boy. And I now, thinking back, maybe it was something like that, like this kid was, you know, going through something or had to endure something, and it was just this hate, this malevolence that he was looking at the guy taking the picture with.
Wow. And it was a matter of, how long was it from the time you left your comics and stuff to the time when you came back and the picture was there?
It was at least a couple of weeks.
Okay.
I had a lot of stuff, you know, comics and the pictures and the spot, and boom, there was garbage had been burned at least once, maybe twice. And then, yeah, there it was again. And
is it possible that, like, your parents, before they burned it, went, this picture fell in there and just stuffed it into your comics?
Yeah, that's possible. I mean, you know, there could be some sort of rational explanation for it. But
regardless, it freaked you out.
Yeah, and the next time when the garbage was burned, I made sure that the photograph was in there, and I actually watched it burn. In fact, I put it in a can and put a bunch of hairspray on top of it. I was somewhat of a little pyro. I like to burn things. Burning the garbage was a treat for me, and my mom used Aquanet hairspray, which is very volatile, and anytime there was a hairspray can in there, my dad would be like, "No, be careful, there's a hairspray can in there." And I'm like, "Oh boy, you know, we're going to have some explosions." And this one, I sprayed the photograph with hairspray, and it burned for sure that time. But it was when it was burning in the can, and I'm sure it was like probably the high temperature because of all this half can of hairspray I had in there burning. But there was a knocking sound that came from the can, you know, like a little knock, knock. And then it just kind of faded off as the picture burned up. And I was just like, wow, you know, that was scary, but it was cool.
Okay, and one of the short little bits you put in at the end is you're talking about a bewitched mirror. And this is really fascinating.
Yeah, that one was strange. That's one of those things that I thought it was odd, but I never really realized how odd it was until I started looking into it. I was in an antique shop with my parents. The shop doesn't exist anymore. It was in East Tennessee, and they actually knew the people that ran it. And while they were chatting with their friends, I was just wandering around looking at stuff that, in addition to an antique shop, they had an antique auction on the weekends, and they had the stuff that was going to go through the auction sitting in a different area. So I'm back there looking through this stuff, and I'm drinking a soda, and I came across a mirror that, the only thing I can describe it was like being in front of a video camera. Like if I raised my right hand to drink the soda, the image I was seeing raised the opposite hand, you know, like it was actually raising its right hand and not its reflecting hand, if that makes any sense.
Yeah.
And I thought, you know, that's weird. I've never seen a mirror do that. So I'm, you know, back there doing all this stuff in front of it, thinking, you know, this is how other people see me, you know, because when you see a reflection of yourself, you're seeing it backwards. So I'm lifting this hand, you know, and I see the other one lift up in the mirror, and I'm doing these things and looking this way and looking that way. And then finally, okay, time to go. I leave. I didn't think any more about it. And years later, I was looking for a mirror for my bedroom, and I was thinking, you know, because there's like convex mirrors and concave mirrors and all this stuff. And I thought, well, what was that mirror that I saw that time that, you know, did just the opposite? And I started looking into that, and only now does such a thing exist, and it's actually done using, like, it's not even a mirror. It's an LCD screen and
right.
tiny video cameras like FaceTime that shows you what you look like to other people. And that just absolutely blew my mind, because I stood there and fooled around in front of this thing for a good 10 or 15 minutes. And now, you know, looking back, I wonder, is that something, you know, came from the Lovecraft estate? Or I would love to have had a little more knowledge about reflective physics and things at the time. I thought, you know, hey, I'm going to come back on Saturday night and buy this mirror and see what this is. You know, is it a portrait of Dorian Gray thing type? I I have no explanation for it. But again, I know what I saw. I know it was the opposite of my reflection that I saw in the mirror.
Yeah, that's definitely weird. What's the most recent weird thing that's happened to you?
Oh gosh, that would be, it'd be hard to, I have weird things happen all the time. The house that I live here in Portland, it's built in 1895. It's described as a Victorian bungalow. And there was a time, well, this has been a couple of weeks ago, we've had a little bit of activity in the basement. I thought I heard something coming up the stairs. And I kind of was standing in a little solarium that I have on the back of the house, and I looked down the basement stairs, and I saw what I thought was my cat, just the reflection of her eyes, the way they reflect in the dark.
Right.
And then just gone. And then I turn around and the cat's behind me. So there's something here. And a lot of times just I've noticed in the back of the house, just out of the corner of my eye, I don't know if it's a shadow person or what, but I'll see something just kind of flip by, like about the size of a person. I'll see it pass by, you know, the doorway inside of a room or something like that. But I don't feel anything malevolent here. I've always been good at picking up on stuff like that. If it's something I don't want around or I don't really need to be around, I can pick up on that and know how to get rid of it. But whatever this is, it's, you know, it's reciprocal. I leave it alone. It leaves me alone. It likes a little bit of attention every now and then. But, you know, you have a house that's 112 years old, I think. You know, it's got some history there. I'm sure there's people that have died here. There's people that have lived their whole lives here and moved on and gone on. And so I don't think it's that unusual to have some activity, especially in an older home.
Yeah, especially if you're sensitive to it.
Yeah. And like I said, I don't let it bother me. I don't let it excite me. And that's the thing. You know, if I let it scare me or if I let myself become absorbed with it, then that's when it would be a problem. But it is. I'm just like, okay, you know, thanks. Yeah, I see you. You know, this, I'm going to be here for a while too. I know this was your home before it was mine, but you know, let's share. You know, just Rodney King. You know, can't we all just get along?
What of all these stories, which is the event that probably scared you the most?
It would have to be the thing in the ditch, and yeah. The Beast of Swanson Lane would be a close second. And the thing in the ditch was scarier because I was by myself the first time it got after me, and then I was by myself subsequent times that it got after me. And then the other thing, the Swanson Road Beast, that was really scary, but it only happened once because we didn't go back around there anymore. And the thing in the ditch, that was right beside my house. You know, that was just a quarter mile or so into the woods on our property, and that was where I, you know, lived and played as a kid. So
I wonder what would have happened if you let it get up to you.
You know, I've often thought about that. Would have been attacked, would have just stopped, would have disappeared. And the second time, I really thought that that's what I was going to do. You know, like, I wonder what that was that scared me. And I was just going to stand there. But when it came out of there, and like I said, I was 15 years old this time. I'm a pretty big guy, and it takes a lot to scare me. But it just, it was almost like that just feral human, you know, like fight or flight type thing. And the flight kicked in. It's just like, got to get out of here. It was just a very primal fear would be the best way to describe it.
Yeah, I'm sure. So what do you have up next that you're writing?
Well, I'm working on a book specifically about the Great Smoky Mountains National Park in Tennessee and in North Carolina. That's the most visited national park in the country. There's a lot of strange goings on there from years and years ago all the way to present time. David Politis has written about a lot. There's a lot of missing people there. A lot of legends, a lot of ghost stories. Gatlinburg, the little resort town that's just in the edge of the park there, there's been all kinds of murders and interesting stuff there. So I've got that I'm working on. There's going to be at least one more book in the Strange Things in the Woods series. And beyond that, I've got a book of pure ghost stories that I'm working on. Don't really have a working title for it yet, but it'll be the first one that I've written that's nothing but ghost stories. Mm.
Any idea when these are going to be put out?
It's really hard to say. I'm thinking probably the Smokies book, it's almost ready. I would have had it done. I had some things pop up, had a death in the family and some things that kind of put me behind. That one would have been ready for fall. It's probably going to be ready by Christmas. Hmm. And then I'd say the other two, late winter on one and maybe early spring or so on the other.
Nice. So you put these out pretty quick.
Yeah, once I sit down and put my head to it, I can crank out. Because basically I already know the story. It's been told to me, and I'm just retelling it to the reader. It's not unusual for me to sit down and write 4,000 or 5,000 words at a stretch before I have to get up, you know, and walk around a little and have some coffee or something. So,
and you're always collecting more stories from people.
Yeah, absolutely. I love to hear from my readers. That's one of the fun things about doing this kind of book is somebody will say, you know, I grew up in this area and we had a similar tale, which is this. And I'm active on Facebook. I'm on Twitter at Strange and Odd, at Strange and Odd. My email address, it's in the back of all my books. It's Steve Stockton and the number's 81@gmail.com. Love to hear from my readers. If anybody's got a story to tell, I'd love to hear it. Especially, you know, if you have something you'd like to put in a future book, that's great. And then a lot of people like just, you know, like to share, said I've never felt comfortable telling this to anybody before because I was afraid they'd laugh at me or make fun of me, but I know you won't judge me. And that's my thing. I don't vet the stories. I don't judge anybody. It is what it is, you know.
Right, right. We don't know. We weren't there, so.
Yeah.
Unless it's really blatantly like, okay, you're just making this up.
Right, right. And I've had a few that have kind of felt that way, but I kind of give them the benefit of the doubt because I think, well, some of my stories, I tell even my personal stuff, it would be so easy for somebody to say, no, that didn't happen, but, you know, I was there. I lived it, you know, so.
Well, I get the occasional disembodied voices in my house, and there was a few years ago they had the last, I think it was the last time the Ghost Hunters did a live broadcast on Halloween, and it was pretty obvious that Grant was maybe, shall we say, faking some of the stuff. And one of the first things that happened to them was this, what sounded just like a voice recorder playing back something as he moved by a door. And every time he moved by it, you heard the same thing go off. And I thought, okay, that's really blatant. Like, you know, like a ghost is going to sound that way, you know? And I sat there and I had woken up middle of the night and I'm laying there for a minute. And all of a sudden from my closet, I hear a voice that sounds exactly like that voice recorder. And I, for the life of me, can't remember what it said, but I just started laughing.
Yeah.
Because I realized, okay, I guess a ghost can sound however it wants.
Yeah. Well, there's kind of that theory, too, that ghosts aren't really ghosts at all, as in spirits, but some sort of residual energy that is somehow managing to play itself back like a tape. And if you think about, you know, an audio tape, it's ferrous oxide particles adhere to plastic, and then that captures the sound, and you run it over the heads to play it back. So, I mean, who knows? Maybe the construction of a house or the walls or something could also somehow record that energy and play it back under the right circumstances. I think there's a lot of things that we don't know, and that there may even be an explanation like that, but even the explanation is not simple, but the explanation would take some suspension of disbelief.
Sure, sure. And I mean, you know, in that case, I still think Grant was planting things, probably to make sure they collected stuff on the live broadcast, but nonetheless, it was kind of a way of saying to me, well, you know, just because it sounded like that doesn't mean it couldn't have actually been something.
And I agree. I mean, those shows, I love those kind of shows too. I love the Ghost Adventures guys, but it's entertainment. I mean, it's a TV show, and if, you know, we're episode after episode after episode of nothing happening, then you're not going to have a show next season.
Exactly, exactly. It's kind of a catch 22 after a point. I think Ghost Hunters were okay being, you know, not catching stuff every week until the other shows started popping up and we're getting more than they were, and then they had to kind of do something. Mm-hmm. But, oh well, that's reality TV for you.
Yep, absolutely.
Well, thank you for spending Halloween with us, Steve.
Oh, it was a pleasure. It's also my birthday today. And This was the perfect way to spend it. I've been looking forward to this all month. So,
of course your birthday's on Halloween.
Yeah, isn't that awesome the way that worked out? Also got a niece who was born on Halloween, so it kind of runs in the family.
Nice. All right. Well, again, people can find you online to contribute stories. What do you prefer, Facebook, email?
Facebook's probably easier. Email's good, especially if you've got something long that you want to send to me. Right now, my books are Kindle only, but that's supposed to change just any moment. I'm waiting for the paperback versions to be available. They'll still be on Amazon, but I have a lot of people that have asked, you know, can I get these in paperbacks? It's coming.
Cool.
Very, very soon. But, yeah, Amazon, Kindle, just Steve Stockton or Strange Things in the Woods, that'll find my books, or the new one, My Strange World.
Right. Well, if they find Strange Things in the World, they can just click on your name, too, and get the...
Click on Steve Stockton, and it'll show them all three books.
And we've covered, you know, maybe about a third of the stuff in your new book, so I don't want anyone thinking we just went through your entire book on you.
No, there's a lot more there, a lot more detail, probably things that I've forgotten or left out just in the spur of the moment here. I get excited when we're doing these shows, and I'll go back and think, oh, why didn't I mention this, or I left out this part. So there's always more in the books.
All right. Well, again, thank you, and we're going to close appropriately tonight with Psyche Corporation's Nightmares. See you next week.
Shut the closet door, it's under the floor, the monster's there. Don't leave me here, among these ghosts. You promised me nightmares the day I was born. You promised me hellfire, you were so sure. I grew up waiting for demons. Catch up to me, burn me, chew me, slink me, thrill me. I don't want the unicorn, I want the bloodsucker. Modify the uniform, cause I'm a monster. Of waiting for your curses to catch up to me. Bind me, chill me, slake me, thrill me. This is a song I've heard before. It's like a voice asking for more. Rocher, éclate, a cause des ailes. On grand spectacle de primavera. I'm scared.